welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 31st of August 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. We are three quarters of the way through the year, and it's the beginning of the week, and that means I have with me today Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, hello sir, how are you doing?
I'm absolutely splendid. I've had a good day so far today. We've had some good weather today, which was unusual, and so I was able to get out this morning on my motorcycle, and I've been for a good ride, and I always find riding a bike is pretty therapeutic. It's what psychologists like to call mindfulness, in that if you're riding a bike, particularly on the roads of Britain with all the potholes and things and the poor services, it absorbs the whole of your mind totally, and so it gives you an hour or two of just pure focus on what you're doing, rather than thinking about all the worries and problems of the world.
Very, very manly thing to do as well, isn't it? Very manly hobby, motorcycling. It's a bit of an extreme sport, and there's a bit of a nip in the air as well, with an autumnal nip in the air. That must be more pleasant as well. So when you're stopped riding, you're not sweating away in your leathers there. It's a little bit cooler. Absolutely. So just the right time of year. It's also a bank holiday, but that doesn't really mean much to people at the moment, because of course we are still locked down. Basically, I'm amazed we haven't had another lifting of the lockdown legislation, really. It was 7 weeks ago, I think, was the last time that they announced that there was going to be a lifting of anything. It's still pretty draconian, and there was a big protest about it at the weekend, and we've also got some news here about what's been happening with the army. Perhaps we should get into that first. The army, Max, you were telling me about the army are hiring a diversity officer or something, and they're going to make people talk about how much they love diversity before they can get accepted. Is that right?
Yeah, this is kind of like the latest chapter in all of the surreal things that I was talking about last week that are taking place in Britain, which is that it's been recently announced that the army have appointed a director of diversity. And this director of diversity is being appointed with a salary of £110,000 a year, which is equal to the sort of salary that would be paid to somebody who's a brigadier, and a brigadier that's perhaps got 20 years service and 5,000 men under their command. And yet this director of diversity is just going to swan in and have this kind of prestige within the armed forces. And apparently the appointment of this diversity director at this kind of salary has been approved by the head of the armed forces in this country, Sir Nicholas Carter, and as part of the army's attempts to make itself appear more woke, because obviously every aspect, every sort of element of government nowadays is under intense pressure to be as woke as they possibly can be. The army have introduced a compulsory objective scheme all a part of their appraisal system, for their appraisals, when I think the soldiers have to write a certain amount of their appraisal themselves, where they're saying what they think is going well and what they think isn't going so well, but they have to write about their objectives, and the pressure is on them to make their primary objective the promotion of diversity and equality, and having to learn all these mantras the soldiers are, so they can write these equality and diversity mantras into their appraisal forms. And we've had a spokesman for the armed forces quoted on the Mail Online this weekend saying, "Defence is at its best when it is diverse, and we ask all personnel to commit to our core diversity and inclusion values when setting their objectives. These high standards and expectations make clear that whatever your rank or role, diversity and inclusion are a priority." it's just completely sort of surreal, isn't it? It's so absurd. You know, government today and the establishment today are like Yes Minister, Dad's Army, and Slap the Dead Donkey all rolled into one, isn't it?
Yeah, all on steroids. It's just unbelievable, isn't it? Saying that what we really want, what will make us really strong when we go and fight the Muslims, is to have Muslims within the army. And you, how can diversity help your army? How can it be a strength? And just recently, there was the CIA in America, and they just discovered that they had this naturalized Chinese citizen that had actually been giving all the secrets to the Chinese Communist Party. And this is the second or third time that I've heard this year. And it's through the promotion of this diversity, the CIA has to take on these various people from different countries. And of course, their loyalty is still to that country. And if you're going to take on people into the British Army that have only been here for the last 5 years or whatever, came over on a boat and then joined the army, their loyalty is going to be to their people, particularly with Islam, where it's, it's a terrible sin if you go against another Muslim. If you report on another Muslim, if you're a witness against another Muslim, then it's a fatwa on you. It's a death sentence for you. So how can that be a strength? It's just inviting in sabotage into the army.
And the worst thing is that all the other soldiers that aren't perhaps of immigrant origin, all the other soldiers are going to be the most woke soldiers you could possibly imagine, and they're just going to be pushed around and bullied, and not going to stand their ground or do anything sensible to in respect to protecting the rest of our people.
We'll end up looking like the Swedish army, where they have mixed barracks. They have the women in there with the men promoting feminism. And then you compare that to the Russian army, where they've got blocks of wood and they're headbutting blocks of wood and breaking them with their bare hands. And then we've got the British army promoting feminism, diversity and inclusion. What does that have to do with killing people? You're supposed to have a, you know, some aggression there. You're supposed to want to defend your country. You're not supposed to be in it because you want to raise black people up to the standard of whites. You want Muslims to be the same as Christians. You want to promote sodomy all around the world as being a wonderful thing. I mean, that seems to be all that Western civilization is really known for now, is just promoting homosexuality around the world and feminism and diversity.
And this is because there's a perception in government nowadays that the biggest threat, the biggest defence threat to Britain is going to be through cyber attacks or through attacks coming with pandemics and things being used as kind of like biological weapons. But beyond that, beyond a situation where there might be state actors involved in any attack on Britain, the biggest threat is seen to be from internal dissent, where the good people of any particular country rise up against the government. And so what the government want the army to be trained to do is not to defend us against in a war against another sovereign state, but to defend the government against any kind of angry uprising that might occur when people eventually lose their patience with the way in which the government are mishandling just about every conceivable aspect of the running of our country. And this kind of brings me into one of the other stories that's sort of doing the rounds this weekend, which is of the rumours that Boris Johnson hasn't properly recovered from his COVID-19 episode, and that he is thinking of stepping down at the end of the year. I don't know whether that's true or not. Boris Johnson does seem to have completely lost the plot as far as I'm concerned. However, what his state of health is like is anybody's guess. But we've got the situation is that the Labour Party, just before lockdown came in, the Conservative Party, just before lockdown came in, were something like 26 points ahead in the polls. They had something like the support of 54% of the population, whereas Labour were down something like about 28. And the situation now, though, is that ever since lockdown and the continual failures and mismanagement and the U-turns and all this sort of thing that's been taking place, and all of the controversy over whether you should wear a mask or whether you shouldn't wear a mask, and how many people can congregate in a building at the same time, and whether you have to stay 6 feet away from somebody, or whether it should be 9 feet, or whether it should be 1.5 meters, all these kind of controversies. The Conservatives' lead has now fallen, so that they are now neck and neck with Labour in the polls at 40% each, and And so a lot of Conservative MPs are getting very twitchy about perhaps losing their seats if any kind of a general election comes along anytime soon. And we've got a situation where the MPs are due to go back to Westminster. And so as part of this, let's get everybody back into the office, back to work policy that's been promoted by Matt Hancock. You know, the MPs are being expected to set an example and to all go back and start carrying out their duties at the Palace of Westminster. And this is from next Tuesday. But the 1922 committee, which is the influential committee of backbenchers, are apparently expecting that they're going to be absolutely bombarded with complaints from Conservative MPs that are very worried about the situation in the country at the moment. And you can't really blame them, really, because, you know, they've been excluded. You know, Parliament was effectively sidelined so that they've not really had a voice. And they've just found themselves all of a sudden, just like ordinary members of the British public, not having the ability to influence what's going on in government whatsoever, and just standing back and watching the most god-awful mess you could possibly imagine being made of the running of the country. And so we've had ministers like Gavin Williamson, who's been seen and is widely regarded as having sort of failed time and time again with various things that he's been doing, introducing U-turns at the last minute, which have then left teachers and left other government ministers wrong-footed. There's been the exams fiasco, where they, first of all, they were going to have this formula that was going to be used to work out what somebody's grade should be, the algorithm, that's the word I was thinking of there, using an algorithm. And then they, you know, initially the government were firmly behind the use of this algorithm and ignored all the protests to the contrary. And then all of a sudden they realized that the algorithm was going to make them very unpopular. So they switched and introduced and decided to accept the teachers' grades that had been going through. And we're sort of, The stories that are going around now are that Boris, you know, could well be resigning at the end of the year, and already other government ministers are jostling, trying to for position, with the hopes that they will be able to take over as prime minister once he goes. And, you know, I've spoken about Gavin Williamson, but when you look at all the other holders of the sort of major offices of state, you've got Priti Patel, who's failing abysmally to do anything about migration, who's failing to do anything to control the demos by organizations like Black Lives Matter that seem to be able to hold their demonstrations without any kind of restraint upon them. Whereas anybody else that wants to hold a demonstration, well, no, you can't demonstrate there, I'm afraid. But apparently Black Lives Matter and any of those sort of organizations can have the means to organize demonstrations, and nobody appeared to have any ability to stop them, despite lockdown and despite the fact that the holding of those demonstrations is contrary to all of the rules and regulations relating to social distancing regarding lockdown. And then you've got Priti Patel failing to control street parties. You know, I spoke about this last week. We've got Matt Hancock, who's the health secretary, had all the blunders over PPE, who still at the moment is going around the country scaremongering, saying that, you know, there's warning everybody there's going to be a second wave, and the second wave is going to be even worse than the first wave of COVID-19, and we should all prepare for this, which is exactly what businesses don't want, because businesses want there to be good news so that they can have confidence and so they can start to build their businesses again. But he's going around shooting the legs out from under them. And then you've got, you know, the situation with Ben Wallace, who's the Minister of Defence, with the what I've, you know, just been saying about, with the Director of Diversity being appointed. And people are pointing and saying, oh, well, you know, it could be Michael Gove or Dominic Raab or Rishi Sunak who could become the next Prime Minister. And of course, all the woke people are hoping that it's going to be Rishi Sunak so that we can have our first non-white prime minister of Britain. But you've only got to look at what Rishi Sunak is doing and the way he's performing as Chancellor of the Exchequer. You know, he's created a massive increase in the levels of government borrowing, and to a point now where government borrowing is at record levels. It's predicted that he's going to be increasing the national debt by, you know, he will have increased the national debt by $300 billion by the end of the year, which then takes us over $2 trillion in terms of the national debt. And so the national debt is going to be larger than our gross domestic product. And in order to try and put that right, he is now proposing a £30 billion, or so the newspapers are telling us, a £30 billion tax grab for the autumn budget, which isn't going to make the Conservatives any more popular amongst their core supporters at all. So, yeah, as I say, it's like Yes Minister, Dad's Army, and Slap the Dead Donkey all rolled into one.
Just rolling from one catastrophe on into another catastrophe. It's just unbelievable when you look at it like that, the absolute chaos. And you think this has all been brought about by this virus. And apparently we've only got about 2 people a day dying from this virus. And then you've got Matt Hancock saying we're going to need to have a second lockdown and trying to scare people. I think you're right, Max, when you were saying last week about how what will stop this will be the people rising up. There was a big demonstration on Saturday that was headed by David Icke with lots of doctors, lots of medical professionals there. Making a guess at the size of the crowd, I would have said at least 10,000, maybe into the tens of the thousands. They weren't wearing masks. They were chanting, take the masks off, and all this sort of thing. They had lots of police there that were wearing masks, but just the strength of feeling that you could see there. And I was surprised that it took off. I should imagine they weren't expecting so many people. But there are, and it's rising up all across Europe as well. There were tens of thousands of people that were in Berlin on Saturday as well. And what I found interesting about this was that the BBC were only covering the demonstration in Berlin. There was no mention at all of the demonstration that there was in London, where I guess they didn't want to draw attention to it. And you contrast that with Black Lives Matter, that there was masses and masses of support for. Last night, I could only find one news organisation that was mentioning the demonstration in London, and that was the Metro. Just one. And it was the same with the Patriotic Alternative last week as well. They did a massive operation where they projected onto the cliffs of Dover, stop immigration, Patriotic Alternative, and White Lives Matter. And it was projected up there all night. It was a massive operation, and that should have been in all the newspapers, and it wasn't. There was like a news blackout, and I think this may be the new way that they're going to be dealing with things like this. They're just not going to cover it in the news. So you're not going to hear about it. You're not going to hear that there were thousands of people that were in London demonstrating against this, because they want people to think that there's, you know, this is still ongoing. This is a real ongoing threat for some reason. It's like they deliberately want to crash the economy. They want to destroy everything. And the Labour Party aren't questioning them about this. And I think that could well be because the Labour Party are just, well, don't interrupt them. Don't interrupt your enemy while he's making a mistake. And I think that could be why, you know, you said last week that the Labour Party haven't been questioning the Conservative Party about all this spending when normally you would expect that. And it seems to be that they've decided, well, we don't want to interrupt them while they're making this, you know, this dreadful faux pas, because obviously they are. If Labour's support is now equal to the Conservatives, and that is just shocking when you think about how much support
that's without Labour saying
them.
A word, isn't it?
Yeah.
They've already put themselves level with Conservatives, and they've not had to say a word in order to get there, which is the incredibly damning thing about it.
Yeah, it's just like putting their foot in the mouth each time they open it. I mean, I do hope Boris Johnson doesn't step down. As I say, I do think that he seemed to be back on form last week when he commented on the BBC banning Royal Britannia and Land of Hope and Glory. And he said, we've got to stop all this cringing embarrassment, and we've got to stop being so wet, and we've got to stop attacking our glorious history. And I thought, well, that's good. He's back on form again, because I have been very worried that the virus really knocked it out of him, and he's not up to the same standards that he was when he was voted in. I don't think he's pro-white in any way, but I did think that he was quite a capable person, quite a wit, quite able to deal with the journalists, quite intelligent, and he seems to have lost all that verve. So I'm hoping he's going to get that back again, because the only person I could see that would make a good prime minister is Jacob Rees-Mogg, and we really haven't heard much from him whilst the government have been taking their break. So I don't know what's going to happen there. Apparently this rumor came from his father saying something. And I don't know how much credit can actually be given to that rumor as well. But another thing to bring up here, I think, as well, you were saying about Priti Patel and people aren't happy with her, because they were saying that she's being groomed to actually take over from Boris Johnson. And right up until a month or two ago, Priti Patel was seen as quite a darling of the right. The Conservatives really liked Priti Patel, because here we have this non-white, she's also a female, and she also seems quite conservative. And parts of the alt-light were supporting her and saying, she's the one that's going to get this grooming gang report through. She's not happy with the Home Office. She's going to make it so that we can see this grooming gang report. And now we've had this scandal with all these boats that are coming into Britain, these dinghies, and they're all being put up in 4-star hotels whilst we've got white people, homeless people on the streets. And I think that has really enraged the British public. And when you're talking about the army, that's what the army should be dealing with. The army should be going out there and stopping these invaders from coming onto our shores. It was released yesterday that they've only sent back one a week over the last year. Only one fake refugee has been sent back every week. And they stopped a plane load of them. These activist lawyers stopped a plane load of them last week. But that, I think, will be the undoing of Priti Patel. I don't know if you want to comment on that at all, Max.
Well, I think just to agree with everything you're saying, you know, it's the first priority of any government is to protect its borders and to prevent the country from being invaded. And our government, Priti Patel is the Home Secretary. It should be her responsibility for making sure that we're not invaded, and it should be Ben Wallace's main priority to make sure that we're not being invaded. And the media and the government continue to allow the notion to be put about that these migrants, and particularly the illegal migrants, haven't done anything wrong. But in fact, what they have done something wrong, because if you break into a country in order to enjoy that country's standard of living, then you want a share of that country's wealth. And you're taking a share of that country's wealth illegally. And so you are effectively stealing. You're stealing the benefits of British citizenship. The benefits of being a British citizen have been earned by our forebears over countless generations in the past, who worked to make Britain a prosperous nation. And these other migrants are just turning up and saying, oh, we want a piece of that. But and unfortunately, our forebears didn't work to create any wealth of anything like what people have in Britain, and we want to just have a share of it as well. And so they come over, and effectively they're stealing the benefits of British citizenship. And so illegal immigration and illegal immigrants should be regarded in the same way that thieves are regarded, because they're taking something that doesn't belong to them, and they're taking it illegally.
They still call them refugees as well when they're fake refugees. If they're coming from France, they're fake refugees. They can't be refugees. There's no war in France. They've managed to travel through 10 or 15 different countries that aren't actually at war before they got to France. So they're criminals from that aspect. And yet they still refer to them as refugees. We still have politicians, especially on the left, that are blaming us for the fact that they're trying to come over here. And of course, it is our fault because we allow them in. But they're blaming us, saying, well, we should be making a safe route for them to come here. All of them should just be allowed to come here. Maybe we should be laying on airplanes for them and picking them up in Africa. That's what some of them have been suggesting. And we've also had Banksy this week. Banksy, the plastic rebel, the darling of the Wokerati, the graffiti artist that basically his graffiti is not really that good, and it's always just supporting mainstream ideas. Well, he's now entered into the fray, and he's spent a lot of money on buying a boat. I've got a short quote here that basically tells us what's been going on. The British street artist Banksy has financed a boat to pick so-called refugees up attempting to reach Europe from North Africa. The vessel, named the Louise Michel after a French feminist anarchist, set off in secrecy on the 18th of August from the Spanish seaport of Buriana near Valencia. and is now in the central Mediterranean, where on Thursday and Friday it picked up 219 freeloaders from off the Libyan coast, including 14 women and 4 children. And this is what they made a point of saying, 14 women and 4 children. Well, that means that over 200 of them were fighting age males then, doesn't it? They weren't women and children. Less than 10% were women and children. The vessel, which also had a dead body on board, was then left stranded off the coast of Malta for about 12 hours into Saturday, organisers said, as no country was willing to take them. And I thought that was particularly funny. Why should any country take them? Banksy should be taking them. If he's going to go and pick all these people up off the coast of Libya, mind you, as well, actually near Italy or near Britain, but off the coast of Libya, he picked these people up. Why should he then expect European countries to take these people? He should be taking them. I'm just the cheek of the man. And basically, his involvement in this rescue mission, they call it, goes back to September 2019, a year ago, when he sent an email to Pia Klemp, the former captain of several NGO boats that have rescued thousands of people over recent years. And she was being taken to court by Italy for human trafficking by Matteo Salvini, until she managed to buy her way out of that and Matteo Salvini was no longer in office. So I think the court case against her was dropped. Now, she's a massive human trafficker, and that's what he's involved in now, is human trafficking. And the fact they took on so many people on board the boat, they were then left stranded. They talk about these Africans overloading their boats and then they're stranded and they just have to be rescued. Well, because they took on so many of them, the boat was, you know, sort of got down to the gunwales to the water, and they were stranded there calling on the radio, someone help, someone help. And, you know, this is the point of life saving. You don't risk your own life to save somebody else's life. And this is the point here. If we take on these people, these people that are basically, they tell us they're just looking for a better life. They're looking to take our resources, and we don't have enough resources for ourselves. Just the essentials of this, we cannot afford to take these people into Britain. You compare Britain to the size of Africa, the continent of Africa, and you look at everything that we've built in Britain. We're already now encroaching onto the green belt. You think all the houses that they're going to need to build for these people. If we didn't have them here, if we weren't taking in these immigrants, we wouldn't need to ever build a new house, because we're only producing 1.4 people for ourselves instead of 2 people for each couple. So we're not producing enough people to fill the houses that we already have. And yet we're told, you know, we need to build, I forget how much it is, something like a city the size of Birmingham every year just to accommodate these people.
It's bandied about that we need to reduce the population of the world in order to bring the world into some kind of equilibrium. And yet, what's being done in Europe is, as you've just said, that the vast majority of people are having less than 2 children on average. And so our population are doing their bit towards making the world sustainable. And yet all the work that we do is undone by these migrants who then come over here and take the place of our unborn children, because, you know, we're the children that we're not having, and effectively undo all the good work that we've done by abstaining from having large families.
They haven't even
that again is another criminal thing.
I'm going to say they haven't even got the intelligence to realise that they shouldn't get onto one of these boats that are overloaded. You know, they haven't even got the IQ to realise that. They'll just get on these boats, they'll put their children on there, and that will be promoted to us as, oh, look at this terrible accident, and this is your fault, Whitey, for not making a route available for them. Whereas if any of us was to take any of our children on a boat like that, the child would get taken away from us by social services for endangering the child's life. It's madness what we've got going on here. And as I say, I did relish the fact that the boat was then stuck and it was stranded. And I did hear that it was an all-feminist crew as well. I can't believe that they've just got all females out there picking up these black Africans, because you just know what's going to happen there. They must have some men on board. Perhaps this feminist woman, she's probably just a figurehead, and they've actually got a male captain there. I can't see that she's the actual captain of the boat actually doing the...
I mean, from Banksy's point of view, Banksy to some extent could be said to be putting his money where his mouth is, in the fact that he's He's bought a boat and hired a crew in order to do all this, but he's putting his money in the wrong place. What people of his political persuasion should do, and it should quite seriously be considered what I'm about to propose, which is the government should introduce what I would sort of laughingly refer to as a woke tax. And the woke tax should be a tax that's paid by people who vote for multicultural and multiracial parties, parties that want multicultural and multiracial, to pay for the upkeep and to pay for the all of the measures that need to be taken in order to prevent this country from being overrun by migrants. And if people like Banksy were being required to pay masses in extra taxes, if all the people of his ilk were being required to pay masses in extra taxes in order to pay for the migration into this country that they all want, then we'd mighty soon see a lot of them changing their minds, because money seems to count where a lot of these people are concerned.
I don't think he's putting his money where his mouth is. If he was putting his money where his mouth is, he would then be taking that boat all the way to his private island and looking after them and paying for everything that they require. Because he's expecting Britain to pay for it, or he's expecting Italy to pay for them. And this is the thing.
I wasn't suggesting he was entirely putting his money where his mouth is, but he's moved a little way in that direction. But you're quite right, yes. He should be required to put up all these people and to pay for their upkeep.
Italy should be calling for him to be standing in court for doing this to them, for picking, because he's picked them up. It says off the coast of Libya, so he's gone all the way to Africa to pick them up, and then he's taken them into up close to Italy, and then he's got stranded, and then he's calling up for Italy or for Malta or for Lampedusa. Somebody, please come and help me. Come and take these migrants. And it's like, well, it's your own fault, isn't it? You went over the way to, all the way to Africa and picked them up. That's what you wanted to do. Now you've got them. Now it's up to you to deal with them. You work out how you're going to pay for them and pay for their medical care and pay for the roof over their head and all the rest of it. It's absolute hypocrisy. I'm sure it's going to make a lot of people very, very angry at Banksy. And I have seen some very funny artwork that I'm going to include with the article today to go with this podcast to deal with that subject anyway. Well, is there anything else, that current events that you think we should cover, Max, or shall we get into Greatest Legendary Britons?
Let's get into Greatest Legendary Britons, yes.
Okay, well, let's get into some of the evidence of Brutus. We talked about Brutus last week, the first known king of Britain, and we talked about Brutus's life story and how he was a Trojan, how he met up with other Trojans, freed them, had a vision that he was going to found a kingly line that would then found an empire which would have no bounds, which eventually became the British Empire. And of course, this vision was it was written down 1,000 years before we actually had the British Empire, and how he came to Britain and there were giants in Britain and he had his friend Corineus and he threw one of the giants off the cliff, and the giant's name was Gogmagot and his friend's name was Corineus, and that's where we get the name Cornwall from. I'm just sort of summarizing all of this here, and today we'll start by having a look at some of the proofs for this. And we have to remember that the first written evidence I think we have of Brutus is from about 500 AD from Gildas, and then we have Nennius, and then Geoffrey of Monmouth claimed that he got his information from a text that was handed to him that was written in an old Brittonic tongue which dealt with all of this, and that was in the 12th century. So all that time, right up until the 16th or the 17th century, it was accepted that this was the origin of the Britons, was in this King Brutus. And it's only been in the last 200 or 300 years that people have started to doubt this. And I think there's enough evidence to show that this is pretty much what actually happened. And the first proof is that we have Gogmagog's Leap, which is actually at Plymouth. And it looks like the hoe in Plymouth Hoe was the hoe from Corineus heaving this giant off his shoulders and into the sea. And that's why it's actually called Gogmagog's Leap. And that also shows us that these giants that were displaced by Brutus, they weren't actual physical giants, but what they were responsible for is for building the megaliths, building the dolmens, putting up the standing stones. So this is why they had the name of giants, because they put up these giant structures. So that's one proof that we have for it, is this name. And as we know,
and they may just have been people who would, by today's standards, and perhaps the standards of other places in the world in those days, have been regarded as being exceptionally tall, in that if you go back to Upper Paleolithic times, the Cro-Magnon peoples tended to be much taller than people are today. On average, they tended to be like 6 foot tall. And so it could well be that prior to the birth of the British tribes, that there were still a disproportionately large number of people of Cro-Magnon descent, and who would have appeared larger than the average. So therefore, perhaps described as giants.
Yeah, they could have been of tall stature, taller than they were used to, taller than the Britons were used to. We also have the Totnes Brutus stone, which is in the town of Totnes. That's apparently where Brutus came ashore, and he put his foot on this stone. That's still there to this day. I don't know how old that is. It's actually in the town itself. It's known as the Brutus Stone. And the fact that we have these stones and these places that are named after these people, that says these people really existed. Why else would you have a place that was named after them? You know, and the names last for years. They last for centuries. We've got places out there in the Middle East that were named after people from thousands of years ago that still have the same name to this day. We also have the London Stone, and the London Stone is said to be the heel stone of the temple that Brutus built. And there has been people that have questioned that have said that this link with Brutus only came about in the last 1,000 years. But again, it's a stone that was linked to him, and that was apparently put there by Brutus. And whether you believe that or not, it's still named after him. We also have the rivers and the names of towns. We have places like Bridport, which is Brutus Port. We have the River Thames, which is apparently named after a river in Epirus, which is where we were saying last week. Epirus in Greece is where he picked up with all these other Trojans. In fact, we have lots of places that are in Britain that are named after places in Greece, places in Phoenicia, and places in Troy. Marazion in Cornwall, apparently that's named after one of these places. L.A. Waddell in particular has done a lot of research into this, and I've got a quote from him here. "Certain it is, I find, that the majority of the chief river names from Totnes to the Thames, including the latter river name itself, are clearly transplanted namesakes from the rivers of Epirus, whence Brutus sailed, and the rivers of Troy and Phoenicia. These were presumably bestowed thereupon by Brutus or his early descendants, just as a similar series of names has been applied to the Cornwall coast to the west of Totnes, and just as modern British colonists transplant the cherished names of their old homeland to their new colonies." And of course, we have New South Wales, New York.
New England.
Yeah, Newfoundland. lots of places that are named after the original cities and towns that we have in Britain. We also have a character called Peritus, which is basically Brutus. It's P-R-T-H-O-O-S. And P can be changed for a B, basically, in old alphabets. So Brutus sounds very similar to Brutus in Homer's Iliad and Homer's Odyssey. And this guy, Peritus, Homer has him in Epirus in Greece, where he's marriage hunting, which is exactly what Brutus did. And he has him as the grandson of Ascanius, Ascanius, I think, was Brutus's father. And in the Iliad and the Odyssey, Peritus's best friend is called Coronus, which is Coronius, which is essentially the same name as Brutus's best friend Coronius, who had this fight with Gogmagog the giant. And Peritus suddenly disappears from ancient classic Greek history, and they don't know what happened to him. So I would suggest That's Brutus in elsewhere in history, because modern researchers today will say, well, there's no evidence of Brutus in any of these Greek histories. Well, that's because he was called Perutus. It was a very similar name, and that's why this Perutus disappears from these histories. Do you want to comment on any of that, Max?
No, I would think that that was an argument that you took from Lawrence Waddell, I would think, because having read his book, The Makers of Civilization, he uses that kind of linguistic and phonetic, that sort of phonetics to project how names developed, where names were passed down by word of mouth rather than having been written.
Yes, that's from The Phoenician Origin of Britons, Scots and Anglo-Saxons by L.A. Waddell. He did lots of really good work into languages and philology and phonetics. I think that comes from the word Phoenician as well. It certainly has the same P-H-O-E-N at the beginning of it. We have Edward the Confessor, who wrote London, a city founded and built after the likeness of great Troy. Now, I think Edward the Confessor is about the 11th or the 12th century, just going offhand. Do you know Edward the Confessor, what year he was, Max?
No, not off the top of my head.
Yeah, I can't off the top of my head either. I think it was shortly after William the Conqueror. And I know he was a Norman king, I think. I don't think it was a Saxon king. And the foundation myth of Brutus having settled in Britain was still considered as genuine history during the early modern period. For example, in Holinshed's Chronicles, 1577, they consider the Brutus myth to be factual. And I would say it has mythic components to it, but there is all this evidence that that it was factual. I'm sure there is other evidence. There's a book written all about this by Alan Wilson, which I haven't actually had a chance to read myself yet. He certainly believes the story to be true. So that's the evidence that I was able to find for this. Do you want to add anything else to the evidence before we continue with the narrative here, Max?
Well, just a word that I was struggling for a little bit was extrapolate. This, the Waddell, one of his techniques is to extrapolate with certain words, and he shows the common origin of lots of words, which therefore demonstrates common ancestry of the people involved who either had those names or used those names. And one of the extrapolations that just sort of sticks in my mind is that if you look at kings, the various empires, etc., that existed in the Tigris and the Euphrates Valley, there were very often referred to, and in India and in the Indus Valley, are referred to as Shah. Shah is an Indian word meaning king, but Shah is very similar to the Russian word meaning king, which is Tsar, which is Czar, and Czar then becomes very similar to Caesar, which was used by the Romans, and Caesar then is very similar to Kaiser, which is used as king in German. So that is the kind of linguistic extrapolation that Waddell uses in order to show the common origins of language. And in his case, because he was an exponent of the Aryan origin of the languages of Europe, this all ties in with that line of thinking as well.
Yes, this is one of the ways that we can tell that these people were all white, because they had these similar languages that can be shown to go back to an original Indo-Aryan language, an original Indo-European language. And L.A. Waddell does do some fantastic work into that. I did an episode on L.A. Waddell while you weren't here, Max, that listeners might want to go and check out to find out more information about him. To get back to the story of Brutus here, after Brutus's death, the island was divided between his three sons, Locrinus in England, Albanactus in Scotland, and Camber in Wales. And Humber, the king of the Huns, then invaded and took over what is now Scotland, killing Albanactus and driving his people south. Locrinus then kills Humber by drowning him in the River Humber, which was then given his name. And as I say, it's because these places are named after these people, that gives credence to these stories about them, I believe. And this happened around about the 12th century BC, and we still have Ulster Scots and Protestants being called Huns in honour of this to this day by the Gaelic people, by Irish people. They still call them Huns because that's apparently where they came from. And again, this shows us that the Huns were originally white. They weren't Asiatic. They were white. And also just some interesting information around about this time, the 12th century BC, in case people think, well, the British people, they were savages at this time. I've got a couple of instances of evidence of Iron Age civilization here. Skara Brae in the Orkneys was occupied from roughly 3180 BC to about 2500 BC and is Europe's most complete Neolithic village. And I don't know if listeners have seen it. It's well worth looking it up. It's a proper stone housing complex that you've got there that's made out of stone with a hearth and a kitchen and all the rest of it. And also, just last week, they discovered the foundations of a 5,700-year-old Neolithic house. That's 3,700 BC. Evidence of Bronze Age burials and Iron Age smelting. And this was all discovered by archaeologists as a result of excavations at the sites of two road realignment projects in County Cork, Ireland. So we don't just have evidence of housing, we have evidence of smelting. And the fact they found the evidence of smelting there is quite interesting, because they say that that shows that there were roads there, because the smelting would have been there by the side of the road to make use of travellers that were travelling along the road. So that sort of tends to say that we had roads all the way back in 3700 BC in Ireland. So when you're talking about this time, which is 1200 BC, They would have been quite civilized people, I would have thought. Not savages like they try and tell us today, incapable of putting one brick on top of the other, because we have the evidence here of these stone houses. Do you want to respond to those comments about Skara Brae at all?
Well, just to say that as far as Bronze Age edifices and Bronze Age buildings are concerned here in the UK, quite close to the Northern Irish, Southern Irish border. I think it's just about 20 miles south of the Southern Irish border, right on the eastern side of Ireland, there is a place called Newgrange, where there is a building there which is basically a temple to the sun, which has been built so that, and I'm not quite sure whether it's Midsummer's Day or whether it's Midwinter's Day, but there's one day of the year where the sun shines down through a slit that's been cut in one of the doorways, and this shaft of light goes all the way down a corridor to a room at the end where there was an altar. So I think it probably is twice a year the sun shines down and actually shines on this altar, which then basically shows that the people that were there were worshipping the sun and that they had created this this temple. Most people are very familiar with Stonehenge and the fact that Stonehenge was constructed by people who were sun worshippers. That's why certainly the stones are positioned in particular places, so that at Midsummer's Day the shadow of one stone falls upon another stone, and so Stonehenge can be used in order to create a calendar, so that they can calculate the passage of the years, etc., and the passage of time. But then also quite close to Stonehenge is Avebury, where there's another stone circle, and Silbury Hill, which is the highest man-made object, I think, in Europe prior to during the Iron Age, Silbury Hill is a man-made hill that's made entirely of chalk. It's been estimated that it would have taken 500 men 50 years to shift the chalk in order to create the hill. So, obviously, a tremendous amount of effort was invested in that. And then, just south of Silbury Hill, there is the West Kennet Long Barrow, where there are a number of burial chambers that obviously important people in those days would have been buried in. So in keeping what you were saying, the people of Britain in those times were far more advanced than often they're given credit for.
They must have been very technologically advanced to understand astronomy and to understand where the positions of the sun and where it was going to be, and to have that measured out on a plan before building this, particularly with Newgrange. I mean, at Stonehenge, you've got it where it hits the heel stone and comes in through a big gap. But when you're talking about Newgrange, you're talking about a tiny little gap there that the sun comes in through. And it may be that they have it on summer solstice and the winter solstice, because I know at Stonehenge they do. They celebrate on the summer solstice and the winter solstice, because at both times it's one time it's the longest day, and the other time it's the shortest day. But they were certainly well advanced peoples back then. They were the same type of peoples as we are today. I don't think we've changed that much over the years. We may have changed a little bit physically, just with breeding priorities. But as far as actual IQ level, I think we were pretty much the same back then as we are now. I think the evidence that there is for civilization, when we see this evidence for civilization, that is also evidence for the white man being there, because those stone structures, the stone circles, the standing stones, the dolmens, we find them all over the world. In actual fact, quite a surprising fact is that almost half of them are found in North Korea, and they were actually built much later than the ones in Europe, which tends to say that we got there later than we did into Europe and into India and the Middle East, and one of the last places we actually got to was in North Korea, and then in China, in the Taklamakan Desert there, we find bodies of Aryans going back to about 3,500 BC, or about 3,000 BC, sorry, and we don't actually find the skeletons of the Mongoloid types until about 1,500 BC. So you can see that the people that today that we now know as the Chinese, they didn't even get there until after the Aryans. So I'm a firm believer that civilization, all the civilizations were actually started off by Aryans, white people, whether obviously they're not still there now, because they fell to race mixing, and we didn't have non-whites in Britain. These were white people that Brutus came across, because they accepted him as king as well. It wasn't that he genocided all these people, but they accepted him as king. So they must have been in connection with Phoenicia through the mining that they had there, because there was the tin mining and everything else that they would then sell to these Phoenician traders, who would then take their wares to the Near East and even as far as India. And I think the first colonists into Britain would have been these Phoenician colonists, these miners. So they would have been aware of Troy. They would have been aware of who Brutus was, and they accepted him as his king. Well, the story then progresses rapidly through the reigns of the descendants of Locrinus up to a character called Bladud, who is our next king of note. And his son was the famous King Lear that Shakespeare wrote a play about. Wikipedia tells us there is no evidence to support Bladud's existence. But if there is evidence for his son Lear, then Lear must have had a father. And we are told that he was contemporaneous with the biblical prophet Elijah, 9th century BC. And I had a look, because I thought maybe there might have been some coins, some numismatic evidence for King Lear, but I couldn't actually find any. But there is evidence of places being named after Bladud. Bladud was sent by his father to be educated in the liberal arts in Athens, and after his father's death, he returned with four philosophers and founded a university at Stamford in Lincolnshire, which flourished until it was suppressed by St. Augustine of Canterbury on account of heresies which were taught there. So that would have been in 597 AD. And the heresy that was taught there was probably the early Celtic Christianity, which St. Augustine had an issue with, because Britain had been Christian since about 150 AD. It was a different type of Christianity to the type that St. Augustine brought. But the fact that he founded a university there, and it was mentioned that St. Augustine suppressed it in 597 AD, that says to me that Bladud was a real king. And we have some more evidence here as well. He ruled for 20 years from either 863 BC or 500 BC, in which time he built Carbadum or Carvadum, the city of Bath. He is said to have founded the city because while he was in Athens, he contracted leprosy, and when he returned home, he was imprisoned as a result, but he escaped, went off to go into hiding. He found employment as a swineherd at Swineswick, which is about 2 miles from the later site of Bath, and he noticed that his pigs would go into an alder moor in cold weather and return covered in black mud. He found that this mud was warm, and that the pigs did it in order to enjoy the heat. And he also noticed that the pigs which did this did not suffer from skin diseases like the others did, and on trying the mud bath for himself, found that he was cured of his leprosy. He was then restored to his position as heir apparent to his father and founded Bath so that others might also benefit as he had done. He dedicated the city to the goddess Athena, who is also known as Minerva, and in honour of her he lit undying fires, whose flames turned to balls of stone as they grew low, with new ones springing up in their stead. And this seems to be an embellishment of an account from the 4th century writer Solinus of the use of local coal on the altars of her temple. So it seems to me what they're referring here is to there was a custom of burning coals, which were basically like balls of stone. So I think that's what was being referred to here, that they had discovered that they could burn coal. But the main thing that he's famous for is flying. He also encouraged the practice of necromancy or divination through the spirits of the dead. And through this practice, he is said to have constructed wings for himself and to have tried to fly from the Temple of Apollo in Trinovantium in London, or Troy Nova, New Troy. But he was killed when he hit a wall and broke his neck. And that Brutus stone that I was talking about earlier, that was supposedly part of this temple in London that Brutus built. And that was the temple that he tried to fly from and broke his neck. And the 18th century Bath architect John Wood the Elder wrote about Bladud and put forth the suggestion that he should be identified with Abaris the Hyperborean, the healer known from classical Greek sources. And I've read elsewhere that Abaris the Hyperborean was actually from Britain. So it could be that it was the same character here. And we have a statue of King Bladud overlooking the King's Bath at Bath, which carries the date of 1699, but its inclusion in earlier pictures shows that it is much older than this. So I think there is some evidence for Bladud being in existence, and he is one of the kings that I've heard mentioned in Parliament. I've heard Jacob Rees-Mogg bring up the fact that Bladud was the founder of Bath, so it was actually put into the minutes of government that Bladud was the founder of the King of Bath, because Jacob Rees-Mogg actually brought it up. Do you want to make any comments on this legendary king? I mean, he's not really one of our greatest kings, but he was obviously looked at years ago as a great British personage who founded the city of Bath and discovered that the springs there had healing properties. Do you want to make any comments on that, Max?
I just find it a very sort of interesting story, actually. Obviously, there is a certain amount of evidence for these stories, as you've outlined. But I would say that for the vast majority of people, myself included, these stories are very new and make an interesting addition to our understanding of the ancient past for our nation, and it creates some interesting stories that I can just imagine telling some of these stories to young children, and the children finding them quite amusing and quite finding them interesting, particularly the sort of Bladud trying to fly and things of that sort, and so. I would say I'm just enjoying listening to you recounting these stories.
Well, it helped to give children a sense of identity. And you think, we were talking 1,500 years ago, and these are the sort of stories that the bards would talk about, and people would know their history from this. We've got one last king in Brutus's line, because this is all through the line of Brutus, and that is King Lear. He's not a greatest Briton, again, and he is legendary, but the story of his life, I think, contains good moral instruction. Leah actually had three daughters and no sons, so he was the end of the line for Brutus, basically. And as he neared death, he divided his kingdom among the three daughters. Goneril and Regan flattered their father, and at the advice of Leah's nobles, were married off to the Dukes of Albany and Cornwall, respectively. Cordelia, the third one, despite being her father's favourite, refused to flatter the king, feeling that he should not need to make special assurances of her love, and she was given no land to rule because of it. King Aganippus of the Franks courted and married Cordelia, despite Leah's refusal to pay a dowry to him. Leah then gave Goneril and Regan half his kingdom, planning to bequeath to them the remainder at his death. But instead, his sons-in-law rebelled and seized the whole kingdom. King Maglorus of Albany, Goneril's husband, maintained Leah with a retinue of 60 knights. But his wife then reduced this by half after 2 years. So Leah then fled to Regan, who reduced his entourage to only 5 men. Returning to Albany and pleading with Goneril, Leah was left with just one single knight for protection. So his daughters completely stitched him up and took him for everything that he had. And at this point, Leah feared both his older daughters, thought they might kill him, and he fled to France and sent Cordelia a messenger when he was outside her court at Caritia. She had him bathed, royally clothed, and assigned a fittingly large band of retainers. He was then officially received by the king and made the regent of France, with the Frankish nobles vowing to restore him to his former glory. Leah, Cordelia, and her husband invaded Britain and successfully overthrew his other daughters and sons-in-law, and Leah ruled another 3 years and then died. Cordelia succeeded him and buried him in an underground shrine to the god Janus beneath the river Soar near Leicester, which was named after him, and allegedly the current site of the city's Jewry Wall. An annual feast was held nearby in his honour. Apparently Leicester is named after King Lear. That's the only real sort of evidence that we have for him, and the play of Shakespeare. And I found this particularly interesting, this Jewry Wall, because I'd never heard of anything called a Jewry Wall before. And apparently it's not named after the Jews, and it's much older than the time Simon de Montfort expelled the Jews from Leicester, which was in 1231. He expelled them for practicing usury against the Christians. And the Jewry Wall is actually made of 2nd century Roman masonry. And there are other Jewry Walls that are named as Jewry Walls throughout the country. And it is spelt J-E-W-R-Y. And Wikipedia says that it is possibly named after jurors, part of a jury. But I'm not so sure. And I was just wondering if listeners had heard of these Jewry Walls before, and if they had any ideas on what they actually were. And you were telling me before we went on Air Max that you hadn't heard of it before. But what do you make of this story of King Lear? I think it has a good moral to it.
Yes, it does remind me of other stories that I can't quite sort of put my finger on at the moment. But it makes you realise, I suppose, when you hear these stories, that that there was probably a fair amount of politicking going on. And certainly even when we look at later times with King Alfred, etc., and the wars that he had against the Vikings and the way in which the wars that he had went from times where he was victorious to times where he was almost defeated, etc., and the tide of battle swung backwards and forwards, that in earlier times, in the time of King Lear, that the same kind of contests were taking place, and the same kind of rivalries amongst noble people existed as well, and were the prompts for these wars and struggles.
And I think it also shows that we were connected up with the continent. We knew what was going on in Greece. We had cordial relations with the Franks, who helped him to get his kingdom back. And, you know, people say, well, you got these Christian stories and Christian stories are from the Near East. And then we got people that say, well, we should be looking at Nordic pagan myths and they all come from Scandinavia. And then we've got our own stories here. We've got our own myths and legendary figures that our bards used to sing about in our own songs. And it's just a great shame that more British nationalists aren't interested in this stuff and don't learn this stuff, because this is our heritage. This is our history. And when you learn about this sort of stuff, you can imagine your ancestors doing the same. Like you were saying, just then, Max, about children finding these stories interesting. You know, the children would have been fascinated by this, and they would have grown up knowing these stories and being able to repeat them to one another. And they would have played at being bladdered when they were outside, or played at being King Lear, you know, rather than kids today. Or I don't know, even if they do still go out and play Star Wars or play war amongst one another. But these are the stories that our ancestors would have been brought up on. And I think it's beneficial to learn them again now, particularly if you're a nationalist and you're interested in nationalism. I think all nationalists should understand where we come from, know some of our heroes. And too many people idolize the Scandinavian stuff, I find, especially if they're interested in pagan stuff. Well, look at the British pagan stuff. Look at the Druids. Look at this stuff where they were worshipping the Greek gods, because that's our history. I don't know if you want to add anything else to that, Max, before we finish.
No, I think you've expressed that very well.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.